So at the end of our hour, some thoughts about the end of life. In the reform-minded environment of healthcare right now, doctors are learning that there is a huge difference between keeping someone alive in the last months and weeks of life and getting a person and their family comfortable and prepared for an inevitable death. Paula Faber's death last year at age 72 after 11 months of treatments is a painful memory made needlessly painful, says husband Ron, by the doctors heroically trying to save her. Looking back now, Ron wishes his final memories of his wife were different.
I would have rather had a really okay 4.5 months with her than this endless set of treatments.
The Faber's story was told by our partners at WNYC. And life extension treatments, all about survival at all costs and palliative care to prepare people and families for death and not postponing that death, may be incompatible. That's what a new report called Dying in America declares. A nonpartisan committee at the National Academy of Sciences says this nation's end-of-life care system is broken and needs a major overhaul to redefine standards of care and the way end-of-life care is financed and delivered. Dr. Diane E. Meyer is director of the Center to Advance Palliative Care at the Icahn School of Medicine. She was on the committee appointed by the Institute of Medicine to put together this new report. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you very much.
So what scenarios are we talking about here? And in your clinical experience and those of your colleagues, what scenarios are we really looking to target in this report to begin with?
Well, I think a very important point for everybody to understand is this is not about an either-or care model. Either we make you comfortable or we put you in the intensive care unit on a ventilator. It's not this sort of black and white choice. Mm-hmm. That, in fact, most people with serious illness in the United States and in many parts of the world have chronic diseases like stroke, like heart failure, like emphysema, like kidney failure, like even cancer is now predominantly a chronic disease with which people live for many years, sometimes more than a decade.
That's a really interesting point.
So the point is really not what do we do when we know you're about to die, although that's an important issue. The point is what do we do to make all these extra years worth having? So it's not a choice between life prolonging or disease treatment and treatment focused on quality of life. It's the integration of those two approaches that this report calls for.
You know, I'm struck that so many families don't necessarily have an awareness of where things become chronic versus cured. Do doctors have a way of saying, okay, folks, we're into the chronic zone now. We're going to be living for a long time with this, and we need to prepare for the fact that you're going to probably die of this condition. Do doctors go from cure to chronic easily?
I think our training as physicians, unfortunately, does not prepare us to think about the long haul with our patients and families, and to help prepare patients and families for what to expect over what may be a very, very long time that has enormous consequences for their future, for the family, for whether the caregiver can continue to work, whether the child's college funds will have to be spent on caring for the chronically ill loved one at home. I mean, there are enormous personal and family implications of living for years, decades with serious chronic illness. And I know from my own experience and from teaching in a medical school that we are not preparing young physicians, either undergraduate medical school or residency, to help our patients and families plan for that and be prepared to deal with it. And in large part, the fault lies both with medical and nursing education, which is still stuck in a pattern of training that might have been appropriate 100 years ago or 50 years ago, but really has not evolved to keep up with the fact that most people have chronic debilitating illness for a long time. And secondly, the way we pay for healthcare in this country is we pay you more if you do more things to people. We pay for 911 calls, ER visits, hospitalizations. We don't pay for the help you need at home. So surprise, surprise, when people are desperate and exhausted and don't know where to turn, they call 911 because they can't get help at home. And what we've got is a system that only pays for hospitalization, essentially, and diagnostic tests and treatments, whereas the needs of most people with chronic long-term illness are for more help at home.
So paying for curative treatments, that's a no-brainer in our system. But making people comfortable in their sort of chronic years whether they're at home or in the hospital, that's a tougher sell to insurance companies and Medicare, for instance.
It's a tougher sell largely because in our legislation in the United States, in statute, in Medicare statute, it is written that Medicare will pay for all, quote, medically necessary, unquote, services. That does not include, for example, paying for a companion to help you bathe or dress or get down the stairs in your home. I'll tell you a story. I went to visit Dame Cicely Saunders in London when she had metastatic cancer. She was the founder of the modern palliative care field. And I went to say thank you and say goodbye. And it was fascinating. Here she was in her 80s, living alone in one of those three-story narrow row houses in London with one rose bush in the front yard, and lived alone, no help, tremendous pain that she was managing with opioids at home. And how did she do it? They had a tuck-in service in England. So every morning at 8 a.m., someone with a high school education would come and help her get up, bathed, dressed, take her meds, get down the steps, give her breakfast, put lunch in the fridge, lay out her meds for the day, and settle her in the sitting room.
And that kind of service has nothing to do with the single-payer system in Britain. We could do that tomorrow in the United States with legislation and a responsible progressive insurance.
Precisely. I mean, it's – so why was she able to remain at home and independent, as was her wish? She did not want to go into an institution because in England they could pay for the tuck-in service. This did not require doctors, nurses, social workers, medication, but we can't pay for that under Medicare.
Let's think about one other thing. Families are taught that if you shift over to the comfort issues of chronic care, you've given up. And that's wrong, right?
Well, precisely. Not only is that wrong, that people living with a serious illness deserve and should demand attention to their quality of life, their management of pain, management of depression or anxiety, support for exhausted, overwhelmed family caregivers, safe housing, adequate nutrition, transportation. These are all things that are critical to a serious illness. But very importantly, and very important for the public to understand, there are now about 6 studies that show that people that get palliative care, that is care focused on their quality of life, at the same time as disease treatment, whether chemotherapy or treatment for heart failure, live longer, significantly longer than people who only get the disease-focused treatment.
Which really transforms and causes us to think about that issue of medically necessary. Dr. Diane Meyer, let's hope that this report really makes it into the sort of front of doctors' to-do lists and legislators and policymakers, because this is a really important issue for all of healthcare. Dr. Diane Meyer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Meyer is director of the Center to Advance Palliative Care at the Icahn School of Medicine.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.